Lecture 12, Andrew Jackson, the Warrior President.
Welcome back to the world of Old Hickory, Andrew Jackson. In our previous lecture, we examined the end of Andrew Jackson's military career, and we looked at his becoming a presidential candidate in the 1820s. In 1824, Andrew Jackson received a plurality of both the popular and the Electoral College vote. However, lacking a majority in the Electoral College, the election went into the House. Jackson was bitterly disappointed when the House voted to elect John Quincy Adams, and he charged that the election represented a corrupt bargain among Washington insiders when Henry Clay, Adams' main supporter in the House, became Secretary of State. 4 years later, Andrew Jackson got his revenge when in 1828 he defeated Adams and became President of the United States. In this lecture, we will look at the first term of Andrew Jackson and his successful campaign for re-election in 1832. The discussion will cover his war against the Bank of the United States, as well as other issues such as the controversy over Peggy Eaton, the wife of his Secretary of War, the spoils system for appointing federal officials, the struggle over the nullification of federal law by the states, and Jackson's policy on the forced removal of Native Americans. Jackson became a powerful and highly controversial president. He reinvigorated an office that had become somewhat feeble ever since the heyday of Thomas Jefferson. First, despite having campaigned twice for the presidency, Jackson had made his mark as a military commander, not as a political leader. He had served briefly in Congress, but his terms had really been without significant accomplishment. He had little record on the issues of the times and was somewhat of an unknown when it came to exactly what he would do in office. Despite his hot temper, his personal feuds, and sometimes apocalyptic language, Jackson actually, at the very beginning of his presidency, took what appeared to be compromise positions on some of the key issues of the day, including states' rights, tariffs, and internal improvements. Yet Jackson would prove to be anything but moderate when it came to his leadership as president. Historians today remember Jackson as a strong leader who greatly expanded the powers of the presidency and set precedents for future chief executives. Andrew Jackson strongly controlled the executive branch of government. Everyone knew who was in charge when Jackson was president. He took on the National Bank of the United States, the most powerful institution of the times, and was quite willing to challenge the Congress. He vetoed more bills than all previous presidents combined and was the first president to use the pocket veto, letting a bill die without signing it. History would also remember Andrew Jackson as an exponent of the new democratic spirit in America and as the force behind the formation of the Democratic Party and, more generally, the formation of a modern-style political party system in the United States. As president-elect, Jackson quite clearly signaled that he fully intended to bring change to Washington. Remember, he had campaigned, or that is, his supporters had campaigned for him because he didn't personally campaign, but the Jackson campaign had centered on the idea that he was the virtuous outsider who would clean out the corruption in Washington. And to prove that, he fixed two brooms to the prow of the steamer carrying him north from Tennessee. Indeed, this was a guy who was going to sweep clean the corridors of Washington, D.C. And indeed, the common folk, Andrew Jackson's people, followed him to Washington, perhaps in the tens of thousands. They witnessed the first out-of-doors inauguration, and they took part in the boisterous open house in the White House that left the White House in need of cleanup and repair. Jackson, the new president, stood tall at 6'1" and rapier thin at maybe 140 pounds. His hair was gray and he had penetrating blue eyes. He carried in his body, the old warrior, two bullets from separate encounters. Yet the Jackson administration opened without great fanfare as Jackson appointed a generally undistinguished cabinet that balanced the many different interests that formed the Jacksonian coalition. The leading members were Jackson's campaign manager, John Eaton, as Secretary of War, and New York political leader Martin Van Buren as Secretary of State. Martin Van Buren was perhaps the nation's leading practitioner of the newly emerging party politics. Unlike the founding fathers, who were aghast at the idea of developing parties and feared that parties would lead to faction and discord and undermine the republic, Van Buren and this new generation of party leaders openly embraced political parties as a beneficent development in the United States that would help channel the sentiment of the common people into public policy. Rather than relying primarily, though, on his cabinet for advice, Jackson also turned to a group of trusted, unofficial advisors known at the time as the quote-unquote kitchen cabinet. One story from early on in Jackson's term illustrates both how effectively the old warrior used advisors and that despite his reputation for hot temper, Jackson also had a side which showed a sense of humor. After submitting his first annual message to Congress, Jackson asked an old friend what the people thought of this message. The friend responded that, quote, "They say that it is first rate, but nobody believes that you wrote it," unquote. "Well," the president replied, "don't I deserve as much credit for picking the man who could write it?" Guy with a sense of humor, a guy who knew how to pick good advisors. We now turn to the first challenge of the Jackson administration that we're going to look at, the Peggy Eaton affair. This challenge, like other critical episodes of Andrew Jackson's life, involved the honor of a woman. In this case, Margaret Peggy Eaton, the wife of Secretary of War John Eaton. Peggy Eaton was supposedly a loose woman who was having an affair with John Eaton, supposedly, while she was still married to her former husband. What does this remind you a bit of? Of course, the controversy surrounding the marriage of Andrew and Rachel Jackson many years ago. Unquestionably, Peggy Eaton was a brash and outspoken woman with an uncommon beauty and appeal to men. Diplomat Caleb Atwater, attending a presidential reception, reported of Peggy Eaton that, quote, "the secretary's lady, whose person is symmetry itself, neither needed nor wore anything but plain American calico. No sooner had she taken her place than all the beauty and fashion in the room gathered around her to do her honor," unquote. But the society ladies of Washington, most notably the wife of Vice President John Calhoun, did Peggy Eaton no honor at all. They snubbed this lady, who they believed to be of questionable virtue. Jackson rose to defend the honor of this scorned woman, very much aware of the parallels of the attacks on Andrew and Rachel Jackson. He also sought to support John Eaton, who was not only his Secretary of War, but his biographer, his campaign manager, his close friend and advisor. Jackson also believed that attacks on the Eatons were attacks on Jackson, the president, and a way of questioning and undermining Jackson's control of government. The Eaton affair also, for Jackson and others, mirrored the conflict between Jackson, the outsider, and the status-conscious insiders of Washington, D.C. It also, of course, reflected big issues about proper morality and proper codes of conduct at the time for men and women. So there was a lot beneath the surface of this Peggy Eaton affair. During a cabinet meeting, Andrew Jackson even erupted over the issue, barking, quote, "she is as chaste as a virgin," unquote. Remarkably, the Eaton affair and all that it entailed dragged on through much of Jackson's first term. Cabinet members and other high-ranking officials were so caught up in this affair that they were challenging and counter-challenging each other to duels in defense of their own and their wives' honor. The affair also had profound political implications, of course. It deepened the already existing divide between President Jackson and Vice President Calhoun, who resigned his position in 1832 to become a senator from South Carolina and a champion of an extreme view of states' rights. Remarkably, the affair also contributed in 1831 to the resignation of every member of Jackson's cabinet save the Postmaster General, kind of a way of starting afresh and sweeping the decks clean. Jackson sought to provide, however, for the one cabinet member, Secretary of State Martin Van Buren, who had supported Peggy Eaton right from the start. He sought to provide for Martin Van Buren after the cabinet resignations by appointing him minister to England. When Jackson was informed, however, that the Senate had rejected the appointment of Van Buren, he is said to have risen to his feet and exclaimed, quote, "By the eternal, I'll smash them," unquote. Characteristic Jacksonian rhetoric. And so he did. So he did. He chose Martin Van Buren as his vice presidential candidate when he ran again successfully in 1832. And after his second term, he successfully passed on the presidency to Van Buren. We'll now consider the role of Andrew Jackson in the so-called spoils system. Andrew Jackson sought right from the beginning of his administration to make good in this promise. Remember those brooms to sweep clean the corruption out of Washington. And one way to do this was to remove so-called corrupt officials and replace them, of course, with Jackson loyalists. Jackson called his actions, quote unquote, rotation in office and fulfillment of what he called the quote unquote Republican creed. His opponents scorned his removals as the quote-unquote spoils system, a crass way of achieving political advantage for Jackson and for his followers. Although Jackson and his advisors claimed to be targeting quote-unquote corrupt officials for removal, in fact, they replaced many other officials without really establishing either their corruption or their incompetence. There is also little evidence that Jackson's appointees were either more or less corrupt or competent than their predecessors. Overall, the actual number of removals affected only about 10% of federal officials, although Jackson did remove nearly half of civil officials appointed directly by the president. Now remember, in a previous lecture we talked about Thomas Jefferson, one of Jackson's inspirations, who had also removed many officials, in that case, appointees of the Federalist Party. But Jackson's policies were different than those of Thomas Jefferson. The removals came more quickly than before and led to something truly new, the use of political patronage to support a political party system, a practice that also spread to state governments as well. Subsequent presidents exceeded the level of Jackson's removal, and they began to dispense jobs to strengthen their power and to strengthen their party, even to the extent that those appointed to offices would kick back part of their salary to their political party. In the post-Civil War period, many Americans came to believe that this patronage system, the one started by Jackson to clean up corruption, was fundamentally corrupt. And there came to be calls for civil service reform. Just as at the end of the 20th century, in our own time, there came to be calls to clean up the system through campaign finance reform. Next, we turn to what would be the major issue of Jackson's first term and his second term, the war against the National Bank. The destruction of the Bank of the United States was Jackson's most important project. Starting with his first message to Congress, Jackson called into question the rechartering of the National Bank. The bank, as it existed in 1829, had been chartered in 1816 for the purpose of aiding the financial operations of government, providing credit, creating stability in the banking system, and helping to create some kind of a national currency. It was a predominantly private institution dedicated to making a profit for its investors. Government held only about one-fifth of the stock. The bank controlled an enormous amount of capital. Most state banks were dependent upon the National Bank, which held their notes and could call them in at any time. Thus, the bank was truly the most powerful institution at the time and not an easy target, even for a president as strong as Andrew Jackson. And Jackson's own coalition, remember, he represented a very diverse group of interests, was divided over the bank, and the public was divided. But remember, Jackson was suspicious of banks, suspicious of paper money, and he came to hate the powerful president of the bank, Nicholas Biddle. In Jackson's view, Biddle was the epitome of the kind of special privilege that he had come to Washington to drive out of power. The rechartering of the bank came up in the presidential election year of 1832, with both houses of Congress narrowly voting to recharter the bank. Jackson had different ideas, though, about the bank. Without consulting his cabinet, Jackson vetoed the bill, declaring, quote, "The bank is trying to kill me, but I will kill it." Jackson used his veto message in that election year to issue a ringing defense of the rights of the common people and a denunciation of the special privilege supposedly represented by the bank, which he regarded as an unconstitutional institution. "We should take a stand," he declared, quote, "against all new grants of monopolies and exclusive privileges, against any prostitution of our government to the advancement of the few at the expense of the many," unquote. Thus, monopolies, exclusive privileges, benefits for the few. That's how Jackson portrayed the bank, and that's how he fought his war against the bank upon those themes. In questioning the constitutionality of the bank, Jackson was also representing the views of many early presidents that the president, no less than the Supreme Court of the United States, had a right to judge the constitutionality of laws. Jackson was also appealing to a broad audience of Americans, suggesting, as he did with his policies on rotation in office, that a corrupting influence could be removed from society, and that equal opportunities could be provided to Americans, and that the republic could be restored to tranquility and virtue. Never mind that the egalitarian society that Jackson was envisioning never existed in America and certainly would not come to exist in a rapidly expanding capitalist economy. Jackson's bank veto not only stirred up the people, but also galvanized the opposition, which would unite around Jackson's old enemy, Henry Clay. Bankhead Biddle compared Jackson's veto message to, quote, "the fury of a chained panther biting at the bars of his cage, a manifesto of anarchy," unquote. So the battle lines were drawn. Bank supporters also unwisely believed that Jackson's actions against the bank would hurt him in the upcoming presidential election. And like today's special interests, the bank was quite willing to dispense money to politicians in support of its own political positions. Among those who benefited from the bank's largesse was the great senator, Daniel Webster. We now turn to the controversy over nullification. It was not just slavery that divided North and South in this period, but the related issue of the tariff. Many Northern interests favored high tariffs to protect their industries, but the export-oriented South, of course, favored a low tariff position. By the 1820s, the tariff issue had indeed become tied to debates over states' rights versus national authority. The tariff bill of 1828 was attacked by Southerners as, quote unquote, the tariff of abominations. It became a rallying point for the doctrine of nullification, the idea that the states had a right to declare null and void within their borders federal law. The main intellectual force behind nullification was none other than Jackson's own vice president, John Calhoun. Jackson, of course, supported states' rights and believed that Congress should respect the institution of slavery. But he was no nullifier. He supported the Union, and nullification was one cause of the break between Jackson and Calhoun. When Congress passed in 1832 another tariff that lowered rates but was still unsatisfactory to the South, Calhoun persuaded the South Carolina legislature to adopt a so-called Ordinance of Nullification, declaring tariffs null and void beginning in the next year. In 1832, Calhoun also resigned his vice presidency to become senator from South Carolina. Jackson would have none of the idea of nullification, and he issued his own nullification proclamation that defended the supremacy of federal law and attacked both the moral and legal justifications for nullification. He wrote that if measures passed in South Carolina, quote, cannot be defeated and overcome, the Constitution must be considered as incompetent to its defense. The supremacy of the laws is at an end, and the rights and liberties of the citizens can no longer receive protection from the government of the United States, unquote. Here was Jackson rising to the occasion of defending the Union. To back up his proclamation, Jackson also asked Congress for passage of a force bill to enable him to use the military to enforce the law. It didn't come to that. A compromise was ultimately reached on the tariff, and the immediate crisis passed. But this crisis was indicative of problems to come, as the nullifiers came to believe that through their strong stand, they had indeed achieved modification of the tariff. We now turn to Indian removal. In 1830, President Jackson persuaded the Congress to endorse the policy of Indian removal to the West, a policy that had been pioneered by Thomas Jefferson and that Jackson himself had pursued as a military commander. The policy of removal came under challenge in Supreme Court cases that resulted from the encroachment of the state of Georgia on Cherokee lands in anticipation of the Cherokee removal. A ruling by the Supreme Court established that the laws of Georgia had no force in Indian territory. Jackson, however, supported Georgia's pressure on the Cherokees and is said perhaps to have declared, quote, well, John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. John Marshall, of course, was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. In fact, there was nothing specific to force. And over time, Jackson did get his wish to remove beyond the Mississippi the Cherokees and many other tribes. Removal of the Cherokees and the so-called five civilized tribes was particularly controversial since these tribes had settled on permanent homes and farms and established profitable economies, commerce, and schools. And Jefferson's original idea had been if Indians could so assimilate themselves into established culture, they wouldn't have to be removed. It didn't help. The removal took place. During his presidency, Jackson removed nearly 50,000 Indians to the West and acquired some 100 million acres of Indian land. Jackson did not personally hate the Indians. His policy was based on the presumption, which he consistently held throughout his career, that white culture was superior to Indian culture and that Indian obstacles to the expansion of the nation had to be removed. It was a position consistent with that of most early American leaders. The new Indian territory west of the Mississippi was supposed to be permanent Indian territory. It was land that whites didn't want. Of course, over time, those lands did become valuable, and the idea of permanent Indian territory quickly faded away. We now turn to the issue of internal improvements. The new market economy plays considerable pressure on both the national and state governments to support infrastructure development, things like roads and canals. Jackson opposed the broad national program of internal improvements sponsored by former President Adams, but he was not entirely hostile to all federal infrastructure support. He supported some major internal improvements. However, he also vetoed some measures, including a 60-mile road from Maysville to Lexington, Kentucky. In his famous Maysville Road veto, Jackson used a strict construction of the Constitution to argue that the federal government could only support certain kinds of projects, those that were, quote, general, not local, national, not state, unquote. Although there would be no broad national planning of internal improvements under Andrew Jackson, during the 1830s, there was a vast support of state-level support for internal improvements, and this issue would continue to be debated by national leaders for many decades. We turn next to the advance of democracy and the party system. The era of Andrew Jackson witnessed an expansion of an American democracy, at least an expansion of democracy for whites and for men. The idea of suffrage for women or for non-whites was not part of the Jacksonian agenda. But the expansion of American democracy that Jackson did represent began even before he first ran for president. His coalition successfully pushed to make more public offices, including judgeships, elective rather than appointive, to eliminate property qualifications for voting, and to select presidential electors by popular vote rather than by the vote of state legislatures. In his first message to Congress, Jackson also proposed some national level reforms. Most of these other reforms had bubbled from the bottom up rather than from the top down. He proposed elimination of the Electoral College, not surprising given his previous disappointment in 1824, limitation of the presidency to a single term, and the limitation of federal appointments to 4 years. Again, this was the idea of rotation in office that Jackson said, quote, would destroy the idea of property now so generally connected with official station and give healthful action to the system, unquote. So the idea was that federal office shouldn't be one's property that one held on indefinitely, but rather federal office holding, like everything else, should be subject to the will of the people. Andrew Jackson was also the driving force behind the development of the Democratic Party, and indeed of a modern party system that would organize popular preferences, promote public policies, and conduct political campaigns. The modern two-party system began to take shape during the Jacksonian era. And through our own time, we would basically have a two-party system that simultaneously would challenge public preferences, but also diffuse those preferences because they were very loose national coalitions. Often it would be third parties that would take the more daring position on the issues and move the political system forward. Thus, America kind of has had the best of all worlds, a stable two-party system that also included third parties as channels of discontent and sources of political reform. We turn now to Jackson's re-election in 1832. This was the first election in which both major parties used national nominating conventions as their method for selecting presidential nominees. Of course, the nominating convention as a method for choosing presidential candidates would continue to exist right through our own time. But in these early days, they did not select delegates by primaries. That wouldn't happen until the 20th century. Rather, for the most part, the party bosses in the states picked the delegates. Thus, the nominating convention strengthened the two-party system. And indeed, from the age of Jackson through the present, America would have a relatively stable two-party system, with also third parties coming into play to channel discontent and promote political reform. Thus, we've kind of had the best of all worlds. And in 1832, there was a major third-party candidate, William Wirt, the candidate of the anti-Mason party. In addition, the main opponents to Andrew Jackson, the National Republicans, as they were called, nominated Henry Clay. The National Republicans campaigned as though they were the champions of freedom and liberty, not Andrew Jackson. They attacked Jackson as a tyrannical leader, satirizing him as King Andrew I. But Jackson, in the end, triumphed, winning a smashing victory in which he amassed more popular votes than Henry Clay and third candidate William Wirt combined. We'll look in our next lecture at Andrew Jackson's second term that followed this triumphant re-election of 1832.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. We hope you've enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Or visit our website at www.teachco.com. Thank you very much for listening.